I want to also take a moment to thank Glenn and Reva Hirsch, who are sponsoring today for the Baba Yom Yotzat of Dr. Hirsch's father, Nassan Tzvi ben Mordechai Zelig Nishmosai Eden. You should have a Lichtagigan Eden and Be'ezras Hashem, lots of nachas from the continued learning and thoughts that are generated from our, from this moment. It is without much further ado, we welcome a person who needs no introduction in our community and in the world at large, just came back from Europe just a few days ago, just from Manhattan the last week. We're really appreciating having Dr. Abramson in our own community with great respect, Dr. Hillel Abramson.
Thank you. Thanks for those kind words, Rabbi. I wouldn't be anywhere else. We're so grateful to have you as our spiritual leader and really help us through the difficult moments, including the next few hours that we'll go through. I want to begin with a joke. I know I've told it to you before, but I'm hoping that maybe the average age in the audience will result in some forgetfulness and you'll... it's a Soviet joke that actually relates in many ways to what we're going to be talking about. So in the late 1980s, huge privation in the Soviet Union, shortage of consumer goods everywhere. The state was investing heavily in resources like nuclear weapons and major hydroelectric dams, but they couldn't provide the basic necessities of life for everyday Soviet citizens. And as we all know very well now, because of the war that's raging in Ukraine right now, the Soviet Union is made up of many, many nationalities. That's the preface to the joke. So the joke goes, there's a cucumber store, and there's a huge lineup outside of Soviet citizens waiting to buy cucumbers. And it's a mixture of a full panoply of nationalities standing in that line. After waiting for a while, the owner of the cucumber store opens up the window and leans out and he says, "We've just learned that the cucumber delivery today is going to be less than normal, so all Jews, please leave the line." Yeah, all you can do, it's low-level anti-Semitism, just the way it goes. So the Jews have to, you know, leave the line, go home. But 45 minutes later, he opens up the door again. He says that we've just learned that one of the trucks has broken down on the way over here. We will have less cucumbers than anticipated. So all Tatars, Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Tajiks, all Central Asians, go home. Right? So those Soviet nationalities, what can they do? They have to pick up and leave home. Finally, there's only pure Soviet nationality, titular nationality citizens standing in line. An hour goes by, he opens the window. He says, "We've just learned that the mafia has commandeered the last truck. No cucumbers will be arriving. Everyone go home." And Petro turns to Ivan and says, "You see, the Jews get all the breaks." So in many ways, as we go into Shivasra Batamas in the 3 weeks, and we think about the breaks that the Jews have had, this is, of course, our national period of mourning, and it should be a period of reflection. And so Rabbi Trump and I spoke about what we wanted to do to kind of kick off this sad season of the Jewish calendar. And I myself think a lot about two particular issues. I think a lot about Jewish identity, which I believe is in a phenomenal state of crisis today with the impact of postmodernism in particular. Rabbi Lord Sachs has written extensively about this in very meaningful ways. And I also think that that's a very new problem in many ways, but we have also a very old problem, that of sectarianism, that of sinas chinam, of baseless hatred based on all kinds of external things that are really irrelevant to the conflicts at hand. And in order to frame my remarks, I was initially intending to say this at the end, but I think I'd rather put this in your mind right now as we look at Josephus, and I'm hoping that Rabbi Trump will give us some spiritual clarity on what this actually means. You know, today I didn't have a lot to do to keep my mind off the fast, so I was scrolling through Twitter, and I noticed that there's an individual in New York who has a very strong political position. I'm not going to name him, and I'm not going to name his position. It doesn't really matter. But he's disliked by a significant section of the population in New York, the religious population. But he came to shul on Shivasra Batamas with his 2-year-old son, and a man came over to him and said, "You're not welcome here. Leave." And then shortly after, the resident's adolescent son was sent over to reinforce the message. And you know, I have to say, it pained me greatly. Even though, you know, a lot of people have a lot of good reason to disagree with his political sensibilities, the fact is he's a Jew in shul on Shiv Asar Betamos, the day when we really should be thinking about not wasting our energies fighting each other, but developing ahavas chinam And yet this is what he and his young son had to witness at that time. So I'd like to bear that in, I'd like to just present that to you as a sort of a background thought piece as we go to look at the life and career of a very problematic individual, Josephus, who I've labeled here as the Roman Jew, and I've done so intentionally. He's one of the most complex figures associated with the period that we'll be reflecting on so heavily today, which is, of course, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And I apologize to those of you who were with me late on Shavuos night, because I've been thinking about Josephus a lot the last 6 months, so you may have heard some of this material. But basically, who was Josephus? So as you can see from the title page behind me, this is from the famous 1825 edition of Whitson's translation, one of the most popular and well-known translations. You can see on the left, Josephus is portrayed here in an iconic image. It's kind of like the 18th century imagination of what a Jew living in the first century would look like, which says a lot more, I think, about the 18th century artist than it does about first century Jerusalem. But, you know, you can see he's got this bejeweled turban with the feathers and things like that, very learned beard, things like that. In reality, Flavius Josephus, who was born in the year 37 and died sometime around the year 100, is our most essential resource for the history of the Jews in the first century as a historian. He was a first-hand witness to the war. He was a participant in the war, and he reflects very deeply on what he saw with the destruction of the temple. He is, however, not an impeccable source. There are many reasons which we'll have to criticize and even dislike Josephus. I myself, although I'm fascinated by him, I find that he's an extremely unlikable individual, a deeply flawed individual, hugely narcissistic. But, well, let's go into that in some detail. I will want to mention, however, if you look at this title page, he's referred to as a Jewish historian. True. He's actually a very talented historian, definitely on the level of the great Greek historians of his era, and celebrated warrior. The warrior for sure, because he fought on the side of the rebels against the Roman Empire, and celebrated. Anyone know why we know he was a celebrated warrior? Yeah, because Josephus told us that he was a celebrated warrior. So he has a tremendous, you know, he really expands his and elaborates on his skill as a warrior. But as we shall see, there's a big caveat to that. But if you look below that, you'll see that Whitson, who was himself a churchman, refers to several other individuals who are of Jewish background, but nevertheless seem strange in a work of Jewish history. And the first one in particular is especially relevant because the reason we have Josephus today, and we're talking about a massive number of works. He wrote four major works. They take up about 18 inches on my bookshelf in small print. And the reason he survived when so many greater historians, like Nicholas of Damascus, for example, who chronicled King Herod's era, they've disappeared or only preserved in quotations in people like Josephus, is because one very overenthusiastic monk, while hand copying out a version of Josephus's Antiquities, said, "There's something wrong with this. Here is a Jewish historian living in first century Jerusalem, and he doesn't say anything about the founder of the church. I'll take care of that." And he added a paragraph, which is known as the Testimonium Flavianum. It's a really bizarre paragraph. It essentially says that, yeah, and by the way, Mashiach arrived, I don't know if you heard, and then goes immediately on to the next sentence as if nothing else happened, which is essentially the literary equivalent of saying, and at that point we learned that we were not alone in the universe, that aliens came and they took over our leadership and so on, and let's go on to the next episode of what's on Netflix. Completely irrelevant, obviously a third century interpolation, but because of that one paragraph, all churches had to have a copy of Josephus for the next 1,500 years. And that's how Josephus largely survived, by that one kind of quirk of fate, while many other greater historians were lost. Now, what is his story Jewishly? The most significant event in his life occurred actually just 18 days ago on the 1st of Tammuz in the year 67. Josephus, who came from a family of Kohanim, the elite aristocracy in Jerusalem, had just returned from a trip to Rome, a rather dramatic trip in which he had gone. Apparently he was in his late 20s at this point to defend some Jews who were accused of crimes before the Roman court. He was successful, and when he returned, he found that Judea was in open revolt. That was in the year 66. The Jews had bloodied the nose of Cestius Gallus, a renowned general who actually had to flee Judea with his tail between his legs because the rebels had so utterly defeated him that they even stole his eagle standard. A tremendous humiliation for the Roman Empire. And Josephus was, at that point, we're not exactly sure how, he himself gives us different versions in his different books written at different times, but he was somehow appointed to be the commander of the forces in the north. He was the leader of the forces in the Gallia. While he was up there during the first year of the war in 67, he was, as I mentioned, a celebrated warrior, very brilliant. Amazingly, he had a difficult time getting people to follow him. He had a lot of rivalries with many other leaders, including John of Gush Chalav, Giskala, many other leaders. He constantly had to deal with revolts among his soldiers. But he does describe many acts of cunning that really kept the Romans at bay. For example, in one particular siege, the way a siege works is it's just as hard on the occupiers as it is on the people in the city. The occupiers have to deal with finding provisions. You know, that's why the Romans always attacked in the late spring or early summer, because they could not attack when the harvest was not available. They had to be able to go out and raid the fields, things like that. So they've got to deal with provisioning. They've got to deal with water. They've got to deal with disease, all kinds of things that happens in the camps. So one of the things that they engage in is the besieged try to convince the besiegers that they're doing fine and this siege can go on forever and it won't bother them. So what Josephus did was to convince the Romans around the city of Iotapata that they had plenty of water, he told all of the people to do their laundry and then hang it over the walls to dry. So the Roman soldiers would see these dripping wet clothing and say, well, I guess they've got plenty of water in there if they can do all of this laundry. Some really clever tactics like this. However, after a siege of 47 days at this northern city of Iotapata, in Hebrew it's known as Yodfat, this is actually a modern Israeli memorial that was set up on the location, the Romans eventually did break through. Josephus, together with 40 of his soldiers, managed to find some kind of cave to hide in, but they were soon discovered, and so Josephus was at their mercy. They wanted to kill him for what they thought was his poor leadership, but he managed to convince them to engage in a rather bizarre suicide pact, in which he argued that, you know, it would be a tremendous chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name, if we were to surrender to the Romans and be sold into slavery, and who knows what else happens. It's far more valiant of us to commit suicide and rather than give the Romans that victory. And moreover, since the Torah says we're not allowed to commit suicide, not allowed to take our own lives, let's draw lots, and we will, in a story suspiciously like Masada, which was, by the way, also a story that we have from Josephus, the lots will indicate who gets to kill whom, and we'll take these lots successively until the last person will be the only person to kill himself. Amazingly, by an unusual stroke of coincidence, Josephus happened to be one of the two last people. He convinced his fellow, let's think this through a little bit, and they decided to surrender instead. So on in Tammuz of 67, Josephus surrendered to Vespasian, the general who was besieging the area. There's a lot more to say about what actually happened, but he ultimately got into Vespasian's good graces, and especially his son Titus. Titus would ultimately continue the war and destroy the temple, and Josephus became the go-to expert on everything Jewish, not only for the Roman soldiers attacking the Judean rebels, but also for the entire Roman Empire. And the rest of his career was spent as a kind of like a puppet of the Romans, a literary puppet. He was brought back to Rome, he was feted, he was given 4 wives in succession. He could not manage a relationship. And he was even given tax-free lands in Judea, but once he went to Rome, he never returned to Judea at all for the rest of his life, for obvious reasons, because at this point he was a traitor. He had betrayed the rebel cause, he had joined the enemy, and he spent the rest of his life explaining Judaism, largely in Greek, which was the literary language, to the larger population. Now, it is interesting to note that he did originally write his first book, the Jewish War, in Aramaic, which was intended for the Jews of Judea and in Mesopotamia, but that version was not preserved by the church, and it has been lost. We don't know how he would have phrased things speaking to fellow Jews than the way he phrased it for his Roman captors in that audience, but these are the documents that we have to work with. As a historian, he was brilliant, though. Described in great detail the progression of the war, specific battles, specific individuals. It is written in the style of ancient Greek historiography with lots of flowery speeches that are certainly embellished from the originals. He borrowed liberally without attribution to earlier historians, but nevertheless, he has a very gripping account. I just heard actually on Shabbos that apparently my senior colleague, Professor Lawrence Schiffman, likes to say that on Tisha B'Av, besides reading the Kinos, we should read the Jewish War. And in fact, I think that's a great suggestion. It's not an easy book to read. You have to get past Josephus's massive ego and self-serving style, but certain descriptions of the attack on Jerusalem are definitely well within the spirit of that day. This image, by the way, describes the Arch of Titus. I'm sure I've shown you this image before, but I really like coming back to it. The Romans made a huge display of propaganda around their defeat of Judea in the year 70, erecting a massive arch in Rome, actually two arches in Rome, conducting a huge triumph, which is kind of like a ceremonial parade that ended with the execution of Josephus's arch rival, John of Giscala, and many other events, which seemed rather out of keeping with what ultimately was a tiny battle in one little minor corner of the huge Roman Empire. Let us not forget that at the time of this war, in the year 67 through 74, Rome extended all the way from Scotland through almost all of Central Europe, the Spanish, the Iberian Peninsula, all of North Africa, much of the Eastern Mediterranean, and this was just one tiny little corner. Moreover, it was not even a new capture. Jerusalem was held by the Romans already for over 100 years. They originally captured it in the year 63 before the Common Era. So why all of the hoo-ha? It has to do a lot with internal Roman politics, where they were trying to demonstrate their valor, and especially a new regime of emperors under Vespasian, and so they made it a huge propaganda affair. This image here shows the bas-relief on the Arch of Titus, which displays the spoils being taken from Jerusalem. I used to say, Rabbi, you'll forgive me, but I think I can get away with this. When I used to teach undergraduates, you know, the World Civilization I course, not at Touro, but at a secular university, and I used to say that the Vandals came and they attacked Rome and they took booty, but apparently I can't say that anymore. I have to say take spoils. I'm glad none of you are smiling, because that means you're not tuned into the way people use that word nowadays. I don't know, I'm getting off topic. Anyways, you can see it's been colorized because my colleague Stephen Fine went and actually analyzed the chemical composition of tiny, tiny microscopic paint flecks, and the Romans, in their garish sense of taste, they actually used to paint their statues. They're not the alabaster pure statues that we see in museums. They are all painted like cartoon characters. And you can see on the left, these are not Jewish slaves. These are Roman soldiers wearing the togas and wearing the wreaths of victory. On the left, it says Leges Judaeorum, the law of the Jews, which implies that maybe they had some writings, maybe even a Sefer Torah, maybe even the Luchos, who knows. In the center, it says Candelabrum Judaeorum, the Jewish candelabra, which of course is the menorah. And the right, it says, they obviously didn't know how to describe what looks like the Shulchan and the Chatzotzros, the trumpets, so they just wrote the phrase Sacra Judaeorum, holy things of the Jews. More significant even than the triumph and the arch and so on is they used one of the most significant tools of propaganda in the ancient world, coinage, which is a way of guaranteeing that your message got out, because people would literally hold the advertising in their hands. And there are about 24 varieties of this particular coin, which is known as the Judea Capta coin. On the left, it always shows either Vespasian or his son Titus. And on the right, this particular coin was minted in the year 70. It shows a looming Roman soldier, often disproportionately large, standing over a woman in distress who represents Judea. Judea Capta, Judea is captured. And they're usually separated artistically by a balsam palm, which is the major export of Judea at that time. Just to give you a sense of it, here's another version of them. There are literally dozens of these coins circulating in the Middle East because the Romans really wanted to drive home the message that they had captured Judea. I like this one in particular because it shows a grossly disproportionate size between the Roman soldier and the Jewish woman. In many ways, Judea was for the Roman Empire like Chechnya was for the Soviet Empire, or one might even say perhaps like Vietnam was for America. And it was in many ways ultimately, well, I won't go past that. So what about, back to Josephus, he turns coat, he becomes a Roman, and in Rome he has to kind of thread the needle between, you know, appeasing his captors, who are also his patrons, and he engages in lots of obsequious behavior, like he takes on their own name. He is known as Titus Flavius Josephus, taking the name of Titus, the one who destroyed the temple, Flavius the family, and then finally his own name. But on the other hand, he seems to push back against that by constantly portraying the Jews in his multiple works over the next few decades as being very brave, very ingenious fighters. And it's very hard to tease apart why exactly is he doing it. On the one hand, one would like to say that he's doing so in order to justify the fact that the massive Roman Empire had to invest 6 years in putting down this tiny provincial rebellion. So he had to say the Jewish warriors were really something special, which we have to agree they probably were, because otherwise why would it take so long for the Roman Empire to crush this tiny rebellion? But on the other hand, he wants to portray the Romans as being civilized, as being hesitant even to destroy the temple. And in fact, in his version of the destruction of the temple, it's ultimately the Jews who do it themselves as an aspect of their bitter, horrific, awful sectarian infighting that dogged them throughout the period. So for the rest of his life, from the year 70 and shortly thereafter when he moves to Rome until his death some 30 years later, he's constantly trying to articulate that very nuanced sense of Jewish identity, where he is proud to be a Jew and also proud to be a Roman, even though he is hated by his Jewish people. As I mentioned, he never goes back to Israel for the rest of his life, and also mistrusted by his Roman audience at the same time. In as many ways, he's living an exile within an exile for the role that he has chosen at Yotapata in 67. We have to imagine him, I think, with a certain degree of skepticism, perhaps a certain degree of hostility, but I think also a certain degree of sympathy as well. Here's a remarkable image that describes the triumphal return of Titus to Rome after the destruction. Obviously, it's a 19th century version, but you can see here the man with the white robe is Vespasian, the emperor, the father. Behind him is his young son, Titus, the destroyer of the temple. He's holding hands with, and I haven't been able to get any art historians to confirm it, but I believe that is Berenice, the Jewish sister of the Jewish king Agrippa II, who is also fully behind the Roman effort to quell the rebellion. And she was in a romantic relationship with the Roman oppressor herself. We have to imagine that Josephus himself had to find himself somewhere in the background there. As you can see, the menorah is on display and there are various hangers-on, and that was really what Josephus was reduced to. But I want to underline one more element that I think speaks to his, that gives him a little bit more sympathy in my eyes at any rate. At the end of his life, after he had published his massive and very popular book on the Jewish War and his even larger Jewish Antiquities, which was the first
multi-volume history of the Jews ever written. He is called to task by a historian named Apion, whose works, like so many others, have disappeared, except in Josephus's response. And Apion comes up with a host of anti-Semitic charges against the Jews, many of which are completely baseless. Like, for example, he accused Jews of being lazy because we insist on taking one day off every week, which is far more than the Romans would. He insists that we are clannish and even misanthropic because we'll only admit converts once they go through the required steps, including circumcision and so on. He makes up all kinds of things, like the Jews were not released from Egyptian bondage by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but rather they were expelled by the Egyptian pharaohs who were sick of them and their leprosy. So Josephus, at this point in his career, even though he has that kind of strange, nuanced, liminal identity as a Jew and as a Roman, he kind of stakes his whole career on a massive book, the very first ever written in human history, a Jewish defense of Judaism against anti-Semitism, in which he lays out all of the reasons why Apion is wrong and forcefully raises himself to his full height to defend the Jewish people. So even though we can see him as a turncoat, we also have to see him as an able defender of the Jews as well. Let me just conclude by bringing us back to that unfortunate moment that I described at the beginning of our remarks, that a detailed study of Josephus's description of the war clearly lays out the dangers and the culpability that we Jews had for our own self-destruction. And this is supported well by the treatment of the Gemara as well. The rabbis were not interested in war. In fact, it's very easy to read the depictions of the war from the Gemara as saying that the rabbis were more in favor of reaching a rapprochement with the Romans, certainly not precipitating a brutal war that would end in such phenomenal tragedy. And I think that's the way in which we should understand Josephus's difficult choices, is trying to negotiate between the peace party and the Biryonim, the zealots who only wanted to pursue their narrow sectarian causes. They hated each other so much that during the siege of Jerusalem, they actually burned the stores of grain that other Jewish groups held in the city of Jerusalem, making us even more vulnerable to the Roman attack. I think the most pathetic passage in all of Josephus's writings is something that occurs at the end of his last book, which is called his Vita, his autobiography, although really all of his books are his autobiography, in which he describes what it was like to walk through the ruins of destroyed Jerusalem and how he begged Titus for a few small favors. He asked if he could have a safer Torah, and that was granted. He asked if some 50 of his family and friends could be released and not sent into Roman slavery. That was also granted. And he asked that three of his colleagues be taken down from the crosses upon which they were crucified, because that was the go-to method that the Romans had for rebellions. And that was also granted, although two of his friends died even after they were taken down from the cross. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope I've given you a little bit of a historical overview and an insight into Josephus, and now I'm looking forward to hearing Rabbi Trump place that within a more of a spiritual perspective. I'll just switch over the table.
through not a lot of demo to work itself out. But in the meantime, why don't we just continue the conversation, because this is really edifying, really thought-provoking, and I wonder if we would put ourselves in the shoes of Josephus, what we would have done, what we would have done, and the decisions we may have or may not have made. And it brings back a question that I think we actually describe as a question really of identity. The question of who we are, the real that we're trying to spread in many very difficult circumstances. And in time of war, it's very hard to blame or second guess the decision. But I'd like to take it back a little bit earlier. While the technology is very difficult, while we could have lights just in the meantime I'd like to take it back to the beginning. And beginning becomes the first time that a Jew, or perhaps that's an anachronistic term, a person of faith, a person of monotheistic faith, has to make a decision about their value system. And it starts at the very beginning, because although it's true that we have great leaders or great personalities in the Bible and Tanakh, the time that really matters is when there is a chosen person. That chosen person has a chosen nation. That's at the very beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha, where there's a person by the name of Avraham Avinu, and he's told that he's special. He's told that he has a journey to make, and that he has a legacy to continue. And what's fascinating is that very shortly afterwards, he has to make a decision, because he's told that he's supposed to have children. And he doesn't have any children. He does have a sidekick, who is his nephew, who he has very graciously adopted in the wake of his brother's untimely death. Haran dies, he takes in Lot, and for all foreseeable circumstances, this individual is possibly his future. This is possibly the future of the nation that God has talked about. And yet they come to a crossroads. And the crossroads is a very significant crossroads, so much so that Avraham Avinu tells his nephew Lot, if you go right, I will go left. It seems that there is an ideological disagreement as to how this legacy is going to be built. And it is worthwhile paying attention to the different ways that Avraham and his nephew Lot try to navigate these questions of identity as they go forward. Let's examine Lot for a second. What does Lot succeed in doing? When he tries to navigate the world of being chosen and being special and the world that he is trying to, perhaps in a certain sense, be part of, we find him again after his separation. The first place that we find him is where? Where is the actual place that he's found? Not just Sodom, we're told, the beginning of Perek Yutes in Bereishis, that he is found Beshar Ha'ir, at the gateway of the city. Why is that a significant description? Oh, fantastic. There really was a presentation, folks. let's move into the section of Avram and Lot themselves. In terms of Lot's place in the city of Sodom, we find him specifically at the gate. Why is the gate a significant place when it comes to understanding the ancient world? The gate is the place where the judges would sit. Which means that it wasn't that he was just sitting there shooting the breeze, he wasn't just taking a smoke break. He, in fact, as the Midrash Rabbah tells us, was just recently appointed to be a leader in that society. When he and Avraham Avinu were separating ways from each other, it seems, in a certain sense, that Lot's way of interacting with society was somewhat different to Avraham. He went to the largest metropolis, the largest successful agrarian society at that moment, which is in the Kikara Yarden, which was in the Jordan Valley, which was where it was fertile. The Jordan River had given promise and much success, as was the epicenter, which was Sodom. And he had been the first, well, called other. He is a Hebrew who has now succeeded in a society foreign to his, so much so he has ascended the ranks of society to be a judge. And yet, there's a moment where he too is questioned about his own identity. And the values that he comes from his Semitic background, now in a Canaanite, Amorite setting, are called into question. So his values, like the value of hospitality, as an example, are now called into question, where he silently and surreptitiously brings in these guests. And when the townsfolk are now opposed to his new policy, he comes out and he says to them, Al na achai, please not my brothers, meaning to say, part of my brotherhood, we're part of the same society, I know you, you know me, we go to the same clubs together, I'm your judge after all, I'm part of your society. Don't do evil in the situation. He tries to influence them with the values that he holds true to himself. And what happens next is perhaps the first anti-Semitic statement ever in society, where the people of the city turn to him and say, Vayamru, Gosh hala vayamru ha'echad balagur v'yishbot shafot. Look at this fellow. He came to dwell among us, and now he's judging us. Who is this person? We're going to do worse to you than upon your guests. A person who sought to integrate into society so much so that they ran to the top of the society, the totem pole of that society, immediately when tension was raised, was rejected from the society they sought to invest themselves in. Think about how many Jews in how many societies have wanted so desperately to succeed and rise to the top of that society. And think about how many times they've heard the words that Lot heard as well. When push comes to shove, and there's differentiation between the value system of the host society and the society we come from, many of us have heard those words. Many of our parents and grandparents have heard those words. And they, in their previous countries too. Echod balagur v'ata shafoit nishpat. Shafoit alehem. This person is now trying to judge us. Now turn to Avraham. Lot has moved into the center of the metropolis. Avram remains in the desert. He remains with his tent alone. And you may actually make the mistake of thinking that he is a loner. He is disconnected from society. After all, when the angels or these potential Arabs walk into his house, we hear that the Tanakh tells us that the first thing he does to them before offering them any meal is, what's the first request he makes to them? Is to wash their feet. And we're told that in fact there were people in those days who would serve the dust upon their own feet. Which means to say Avraham Avinu clearly demarcates himself as a separatist. He is not living in the city. He's living on his own terms. And you come to him, you abide by his terms. And you may make the mistake of thinking that Avraham Avinu therefore is completely separate to society until the next conversation in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals to Avraham Avinu what's about to befall the center of the times at this point in time in the valley of the Jordan, that destruction which is imminent. And Avraham Avinu, as opposed to saying good for them, turns around and takes his own personal credit and emotional bandwidth to argue with the Creator himself on behalf of these people who really truly deserve their imminent demise. Avraham Avinu is a person who straddles two worlds. He straddles the world of being separate, living on one's own values, in one's own tent, at the same time caring for the universal, not just the particularistic, in society. He threaded the needle somewhat differently to Lot. And time again, whether it be the battle before the five kings, where he cared for society and didn't take anything in return, Avraham Avinu managed to remain apart and yet a part of society at the same time. And now if we fast forward to the time where he has to negotiate with the people of the land, people he's not necessarily had a relationship with up till now, they're the B'nai Ches, we hear the fascinating conversation in which he says to them the words which Rav Soloveitchik built an entire essay upon, and he says the following. He says, Ger v'toshav anichi emochem. I am both a ger, a foreigner, and a citizen among you. And that's precisely the place that Avraham lives. That's precisely the point and the space, that very small window that we all live in. As a ger, a foreigner to the societies which have adopted us and rejected us, and yet a toshav at the same time, invested in that society, taking the best and appreciating the best, sharing our values and learning from the values of the society around us. The ger, the toshav. And in fact, the response to this bid, the response to this attempt at identity which has so successfully led Avraham and his children throughout all generations and places, are the way they turn around. And as opposed to Lot, who they accused of being the foreigner who infiltrated them, they turn to him and say in the next pasuk, Adoni, Nasi Elakim Ata Besachenu. You are the Prince of God. Trying to be the Ger Toshav is the ability to be able to be a Nasi Elakim. The success of trying to be part of society and trying to be apart from society. That is the question of identity which Avraham Avinu raised, the question which Lot also raised and failed at answering, and the question which all of us have to answer the same way. This is the realm. This is the very small tightrope, the thin tightrope that we walk. In the words of Soloveitchik in his essay, entitled The Stranger and the Resident, based on the pasuk that Avraham Avinu quoted to Lot, I quote Soloveitchik's writing which are resonant as much today as they were when the day they were written. Abraham's definition of his dual status, we believe, describes with profound accuracy the historical position of the Jew who resides in a predominantly non-Jewish society. He was a resident like other inhabitants of Canaan, sharing with them the concern for the welfare of society, digging wells and contributing to the progress of the country in loyalty to its government and institutions. Here, Abraham was clearly a fellow citizen, a patriot among compatriots, joining others in advancing the common welfare. However, there was another aspect, the spiritual, in which Abraham regarded himself as a stranger. His identification was and solidarity with his fellow citizens in the secular realm did not imply his readiness to relinquish any aspects of his religious uniqueness. He was different in faith and was governed by perceptions, truths, and observances which set him apart from the larger faith community. In this regard, Abraham and his descendants would remain strangers. In fact, he is called Avram HaIvri. Ivri comes to the word, that's the word Hebrew, and Chazal give the interpretation that the word Hebrew means to say that the whole world is me'ever echad, is on one side, and he is on the other. Although we don't use that term as much today, the term Hebrew, we've used the word Jew today, perhaps Israelite later, was earlier as well. It is important to remember the term Hebrew being on one side of the river, being at odds with society, being countercultural, at the same time appreciative of the culture one's in. This fast forward to another time. This is in a certain sense the proto-diaspora Jew, because here Avram Avinu is living in the land of Israel, but it's not yet his. Fast forward a number of years, and the Israelites are now a nation with a state, with a government, with an army, and then their sense of identity is very much bound with nationhood. What happens at the end of that? What happens if we fast forward to the end of this period of time, and we now encounter a time when, in fact, they are no longer sovereigns, when they are no longer in their own state? We move to a time when the prophets of the time try to navigate this particular question once again. And we hear about it by two colleagues, two compatriots. Most people are not aware of the fact that they lived at the same time, although one is a senior colleague and one is a junior colleague. The one is Yirmiyahu and the other one is Yechezkel, both witnessing the destruction, one from inside Israel and one from outside of Israel. In both of their arguments, it is important to appreciate the very narrow balance they are trying to create. The first is a letter which is written by Yirmiyahu in the years which are leading up to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. If you remember, when learning Tanakh, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the first Beis HaMikdash, was a progression. It did not happen in one moment, and there were multiple stages of exile. You would think that people would learn, but they did not. There were multiple tiers of exile, where there were Israelites who were exiled at various periods in time through the period of the last four kings of Israel in short succession. After one of the most significant of those exiles, in which Yechezkel as a young boy was taken, in which Daniel and Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah were taken to Babylon to become Babylonian subjects, at which point there were many Israelites living in Israel, now under a puppet king, subservient to the Babylonian forces, Yirmiyahu writes a letter to his colleagues in the diaspora. And at this point in time, Yirmiyahu could easily say, "I told you so," because he had been warning them and they ignored him. And not only did they ignore him, they tried to sabotage his status, they tried to kill him, they tried to malign him. Yirmiyahu had every right to say, "I told you so, and enjoy your desserts." But he did not. He wrote the most remarkable letter in which he says the following. I'd like to quote from you this letter written to the Jews of the diaspora at this point in time. Perhaps Jew is a premature description. Here's what he says. How is it going to ensure, if you put yourself in Yirmiyahu's mind, how is it going to ensure the posterity of the Jewish future? How is he going to ensure that Judaism remains an identity and not simply a culture or an accent? He turns to them, he says, the rather unintuitive lines. Benu batim v'shevu. Build houses and stay there. V'nitu ganos. Plant gardens. V'ichles piryon. Thank you. Eat of their fruit. Kechu nashim v'alidu banim v'anos. Marry. Have children, establish families. Kechu livneichem nashim v'es b'noseichem tenu la nashim. Establish your families. V'telad l'banim v'anos. Have children again. U'revu sham v'altimatu. Don't diminish. Seek out the peace of the city that you find yourselves in your exile. And pray for its welfare in that place, whether that be in Babylon, the Iberian Peninsula, Greece, England, America, wherever it is that you find yourself, which is why on Shabbos we have a Misha Berach for the Shlomo Medina. Originally going back to Yirmiyahu's request. Kibi Shlomo Yielachom Shalom. Because in its peace, you will find peace. And you think to yourselves, how is this model going to stand? How is Yirmiyahu's dream of the future ever going to be a future? Give it two generations, and all of the Jews will be in Babylonian schools. They'll be talking Babylonian, having Babylonian friends, and they're gone. How could Yirmiyahu possibly expect that this model will be successful for the Jewish future? It doesn't take so long to enculturate. One of the answers is because Yirmiyahu was a prophet, and he knew that this exile was short-lived. And that's why at the end of the prophecy he says, because Hashem reminds you that b'shivim shana, in 70 years, efkod eschem, I will take you back. So on the one hand, this is a much shorter-lived exile than perhaps the one that we're looking at now, almost 2 millennia later. However, ideologically speaking, Yirmiyahu also understood something quite remarkable. In the words of Rabbi Sachs in To Heal a Fractured World, he makes the following observation. This was a wise and far-sighted policy which shaped Jewish behavior from then and to present. Jews were to maintain their identity as Jews, but at the same time contribute to the societies in which they belonged. If belonging is not too generous a word to describe the marginal and disenfranchised existence to which Jews were so often condemned. For most of Jewish history, Jews were not allowed to be part of society. What Yirmiyahu was saying is try to the best of your ability to be part of that society and seek its welfare. Something which Jews have done incredibly, perennially well in every society they have addressed, even though we've heard the voice of those who said the same things to Lot. This is the same question that's being raised. Now let's turn to his colleague in the north. Why the north? Because at this point in time, Yechezkel is already in exile. He witnesses the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash from an exile perspective. In fact, if you read his description of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, he is placed above Jerusalem. He has taken a prophetic dream, or whether it be reality, above Jerusalem, witnessing the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash himself from the air. In this, he describes a particular event in the 20th chapter of Yechezkel, in which a group, a passe of elders, Babylonian Jewish elders, come to him and ask him a question. He tells us that they ask a question which is so upsetting to him that he responds quite emotionally and viscerally to them, and he tells them the words, Haloi loy siye, whatever it is that you're asking for will never be. What is it they were asking for? If you read the Psukim in Yechezkel, it's not abundantly clear, but one thing does come out. One of the requests they say is, Niye kagoyim, we should be like the nations. The Gemara in Sanhedrin and in Baba Basra embellishes the subtext of this conversation to the following request. They said, Eved shemachor loy rabbi, a servant who is sold down the river by their master, does he have any terms of endearment to that past master or not? What is the question they're really asking? If God essentially rejected us, do we have an identity as a Jew any longer? Is there any space left for the rejected son? Is there a place to have a Jewish identity in which Judaism, in a world in which Judaism was completely rejected? That's the question they were asking, to which Yechezkel says, no matter how hard you try, you will not be able to escape your Jewish identity. No matter how far you run, God will pull you out and judge you for your misdemeanors in your societies. Which means to say, Yechezkel's question, the question of the Jews already in exile, was the opposite question of those asking or those receiving the letter from Yirmiyahu. Those receiving the letter from Yirmiyahu were told to invest in societies. The ones in the times of Yechezkel were already so embedded in their societies, they thought there was nothing left to hold on to. And yet Yechezkel reminds them that no matter how far you go, your identity will never escape you. And sometimes the colloquial reminder, which is that if Jews do not make Kiddush, the non-Jews make Havdalah. And that's something which has haunted us throughout all of history, and that is putting together Yirmiyahu's letter and Yechezkel's warning. On the one hand, to be part of society, on the other hand, to remain apart from society. The same vision that Avraham Avinu had, put into the terms of the diaspora Jew the first time they faced with it, post-destruction by the two leaders of the generation. Let's go a little further into today's society. Judaism today has a very difficult balancing act to follow. We live in a society which we appreciate deeply, a society, and speaking as an outsider, a person who has moved to the United States of America, has so many incredible things to contribute to society, morality, and the world at large. And yet it's a society which has many things at odds with Judaism as a whole. And as an outsider, seeing them from that perspective is a reminder of how much at odds we are with them. Two areas and arenas that we ourselves today are fighting when it comes to our question of identities. Our own identity as a Jew, as part of society, and apart from society. The question that Avram dealt with, Lot dealt with, Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel also dealt with. And perhaps it's at the beginning of the 3 weeks, it's worthwhile thinking about these two descriptions. One is Judaism and societal norms. There was an article written in the year 2019 by Rabbi Jeremy Weider in The Commentator. I highly recommend it, about society and the Jews and being part of society. He makes the following observation. I think it's a very important observation. There was a question sent to the Nodi Bihura, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, who was the chief rabbi at the time of Prague, following the Maharal, and he wrote extensively. He wrote a commentary on the Gemara. He wrote a commentary on Shulchan Aruch. He wrote a very famous response. He named them not after himself, but after his parents. Yehuda was his father's name. Tzlach, Tzli on the Nefesh Chaya's commentary on the Gemara was after his mother, Chaya. His name was Yecheskel. But nonetheless, so in the Noda Yehuda, he writes the following question, a question which seems to be a problem of modern society. There was a Jew who came across great wealth. And this Jew did not just come across great wealth, but great estates as well. In these estates were not just simply a large house, but he actually owned towns, villages, and fields. And his question became, can he go hunting in his newly acquired forests? That's the question. Is there a Torah prohibition against hunting? A question which was not raised really up till now, because it was not a problem that diaspora Jewry had ever encountered. And he goes through the halachic discussions of baltashkes, whether there's an issue of baltashkes, or whether actually for sport is a use. And he just goes into to many discussions of tsar balei chayim, depending on how one kills animals. And in the end of the day, he concludes and he says the following words. I like to quote those words because it's significant to us now. He says, to say that there's a halachic issur on the prohibition of hunting is not a concern. He says, hine, ad koi devorenu bin tzaradin. But that's when it comes to the legal side of things. That's when it's the law. Amnon. Nonetheless, he says, mo'od ani tama. I'm quite concerned. I'm quite worried. Al guf hadavar. On the actual question itself. Look in the Bible. Who are the only people who are hunters? Are Nimrod and Esav. They are not our progenitors and they are not our role models. This is not the way of Jews. He says, go find out what it is that Jews have done for all of years and question whether this is a significant step upwards or step downwards. Because here's one of the funny things about when Jews integrate into society, they do whatever society around them does. They dress like society around them. They go to the same clubs or create the same ones which are parallel. They take up the same hobbies as the society around them. They smoke cigars just in the same way as society around them. Whatever it is that the sport of that society is. And the nobody who will ask the question is this an advancement for our Jewish culture? All the things we adopt from around us, the way we drive, the way the houses we buy, the things that we do, is this an advancement just because we could? President George W. Bush, after 9/11, addressed the American people and said, this is not going to shake us. Go return to the shopping malls and carry on shopping. What he meant to say was, go back to normality. And the question is normality of the commercial consumer life our reality or not? There are many wonderful things in America. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, being part of society, appreciating the society, is everything that the society's norms are, is it who we are as well? You know, there are different groups when it comes to Judaism and dealing with society. There are those who, on the we'll call the more right-wing side of the spectrum, whether it be here in Israel, view the government as something that can be milked, view the government as something that we can get things from, but we really have no interest in aligning ourselves with or being part of. And then you move to the other side, which is hook, line, and sink will be more of that particular country than the country itself. And they'll be the forefront of every progressive issue. These are two sides which Jews have fallen part of. And the question is about the middle, where we live. We respect the norms of society, respect the government, the offices of government, we respect the values and the norms of society. At the same time, we're not exactly precisely that society. And just because it's possible doesn't mean to say it's a value. Today, perhaps one of the greatest challenges is not what's called Yetzer Hara, but in the names of Rav Yaakov Nagin from Israel says a beautiful thing. It's what's called Yetzer HaNachas, which means say not the good or the evil, but the good or the easy. We're in a question in society in America itself. Forget Jews. America's at a point where the question between values or consumerism, the question between entertainment versus values, the way we live, is a question that American society is facing, and we as Jews have to ask ourselves that question. We have to ask ourselves, how much of a ger and how much of a toshav am I in the society? Do we still live for values, or are we the product of some consumer market? Which is one side of it. Moving to another, the second point, and that is government itself. Jewish Democrats and Jewish Republicans. Is there such a thing as a Jewish Democrat? Is there such a thing as a Jewish Republican? Hot waters. Rabbi Trump, don't touch this. But let me ask you a question. Is there a question? Is there anything, although people may say this, is Judaism on the right side or the left side of the aisle? And the answer is Judaism does not speak politics. Judaism speaks issues. And some of those issues land up on the one side of the aisle, and some of those issues land up on the other side of the aisle. Judaism does not necessarily align itself with one political leaning. We just witnessed the overturning of Roe versus Wade, a very, very complex issue. Judaism does not align itself 100% with pro-life or pro-choice. It's important to appreciate the subtleties in which Judaism deals with it. As we spent a little bit of time learning a few weeks ago in our Shkamashir and appreciating the OU statement on it, it's complex. It's much more than simply black or white. How does Judaism relate to gun control? It's not so simple. Although it's true that every side will rally parts of the Bible to their side in order to augment their position, it is not so clear that Judaism has one policy in understanding what the Second Amendment means. When it comes to value issues like environmentalism, personal property, welfare, does Judaism align itself hook, line, and sinker with one side, the red or the blue? And the answer is no. And it's important for ourselves not to fall into the precipice of what society is doing today, which is extremism, and viewing that there is only one right way, and the other way is actually dangerous and endangering the future of society. It's important to realize that Judaism views issues, and each issue needs to be addressed, and not to fall into the norms of society, which is slowly turning into a spiral of chaos. This is the question, perhaps put into more real terms. The questions that Josephus had to deal with in his times were very complex questions of who he was as a Jew and who he was as a Roman. If we reverse our way backwards to Avraham Avinu and Lot, they struggled with the same thing. Fast forward to the first diaspora Jewry at the time of Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel. They also had to make very difficult decisions. How much they invest, how much they stay apart. How much they run from the Judaism, how much they stay apart of their Judaism and appreciate the norms of society and rise to the top like Daniel did. Like Daniel as a Babylonian Jew did. Although eating separately in the king's palace was the most respected advisor in the Babylonian court. Trying to find those balances of those people who were able to do these things. And finally coming to our day and taking a step, a meta-analysis of ourselves. Taking a step out of our identity as Jews in whichever society we find ourselves and asking which values align themselves with Judaism, which values have enriched our Judaism, and which values perhaps are subtly not the way that we're going. This is a question which continues to ask itself of us. But not so much about us, but also about our children and grandchildren. Because the decisions we make in our societies and our community will affect their identity too. I thank everybody for their time. Have a wonderful and meaningful day.